Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In this edition of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black, author of Geopolitics and the Quest for Dominance, explains how calculations over Europe's balance of power and the Eastern Question set up the conditions for what became the great game rivalry between Russia and Britain.
The great game is usually thought of in terms of the competition between Britain and Russia in the 19th century, and specifically over Central Asia, with Britain expanding out from its possessions in India and Russia expanding southwards, and the two of them confronting each other over a wide tranche, but in particular over what is now Afghanistan. And it is therefore a matter that has received considerable attention since conflict in Afghanistan resumed, or renewed anew, if you like, in the late 1970s, with first the Soviet invasion there, and then eventually from 2001 onwards, American-led coalition forces. And that is one way of looking at it. What I want to try and do is to put it in a broader context. And that broader context is not one in which there is just one single story. And it's one in which we bring in a number of elements. And I'm going to do that. It's going to take a long time. If I wanted to make it simple, we'd get it all wrapped up in one thing, and we could conclude it with the recent abandonment, evacuation, debacle, whatever phrase you wish to use, in terms of Western policy in Afghanistan. What I want to suggest is a more complex reality, and a more multifaceted reality. And let me make it clear, I'm primarily, in this respect, an international relations scholar with an interest in the development of military systems. And I, if you like, am looking down on it with all the dangers that that poses. First, I'm well aware that real people risked and lost their lives because what one is talking about. And there is that very human dimension. And secondly, but linked to that, there is the question that a set of international crises and issues that are looked at in from one dimension, from London or St. Petersburg, or indeed now Washington, looks very different from the point of view of the man and woman on the ground. And those different scales, those contrasting scales, are significant. In one of my books, I quote Lord Salisbury, Robert III, Marquess of Salisbury, Foreign Secretary and then British Prime Minister, who commented on the extent to which looking at this area with maps of differing scales had very many consequences. And I myself can recall that in 1979, because in 1979, when the Soviet forces invaded Afghanistan, I was actually staying with a former Conservative cabinet minister. I was working on the family papers from a historical perspective. And we looked at the television together, and there was discussion in the television of how the Soviet forces in Kandahar were close to the Gulf, what we used to call the Persian Gulf, and the Arabian Sea. And I thought, well, yes, but it does depend what scale map you're looking on. So let us start off by offering those caveats. And what we're going to do is we're going to go a long way back. We're going back to the 17th century, and we're going to run this story up to the Cold War in the 20th century. And we're going to say that what is often called the Great Game is a view upon a stage in what possibly could be best called, or from a different perspective, called the Eastern Question, though from the perspective of Kandahar or Lahore or Beijing, it was certainly not an Eastern question. It was in many senses a Western question. Anyway, let's look at it from that perspective. And we'll start off with the greatest historian to write in the English language, Edward Gibbon, who in his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which came out out from 1776 to 1788. It's a multi-volume work, and which in fact is a history of the world to the 16th century, asks the question in book four, can it happen again? He didn't use quite that newspaper headline style, but, you know, in Gibbonian terms, he said that, can it happen again? Can what he and we, fairly or unfairly, called barbarians, take over again? Because what he was looking back at from the perspective of 1776 to 88 was the traumatic episodes of, if you like, the entire period which we call the Middle Ages, the post-classical period, what he identified with the fall first of the Western Roman Empire, 410, 476 being the classic dates, and then, which he dramatically describes in his work, the fall of the Eastern Roman Empire to Mehmed II's Ottoman forces in 1453. So in other words, you have the theme of invasions of what you might in modern terms call the European space, what I think it's fairer to say people would have considered by the late 4th, early 15th, early 5th centuries Christendom, by forces from the East. And there was a sense of a continual process of challenges from the East, whether one's talking about Goths or Sassanids, whether one's talking about Huns and Avars or Arabs, whether one is talking about Magyars or subsequently, let's say in the 13th century, Mongols. Differing invaders going to particularly different places, but nevertheless getting a long way. I mean, the Magyars, having established themselves in Hungary, get defeated at the Lechveld in 955 near Munich. The Mongols in 1241 destroy at Lignitz the Polish army, and at Mohai the Hungarian army, and they advance into the Dinaric Alps of what was later called Yugoslavia. If one moves on, the Arabs, of course, in the 8th century and 9th century, overrun most of Byzantium. And indeed, the boundaries of Christendom very much change, with areas that had been much part of both the world of Romanitas and then the world of Christendom, Egypt, Syria, what we would now call variously Israel or Palestine or Lebanon or whatever names we wish to use, all brought under the sway of Islam. And of course, in the 14th century, you have the Ottoman advance, major battles at Kosovo, at Varna. The Ottomans take Constantinople in 1453. There are Ottoman troops landed at Otranto in Apulia in Italy in 1480. They don't stay for very long, but it shows their impact. The Ottomans take over Hungary from 1526. They launch their first siege of Vienna, unsuccessfully so, in 1529. They are a major presence, and that continues to be the case. As you may know, the second siege of Vienna is 1683. The Ottomans do badly in the subsequent war, and even worse in the war from 1716 to 18, losing Belgrade. But in case you sort of handle glibly some narrative of Ottoman decline, in fact, by 1739, they've beaten the Austrians and they're back in Belgrade. So the point is that by the time we've got to 1739, we have a situation which is not too wildly different in terms of the years we're talking about, from when Gibbon is starting to conceive, which he does in 1764, his decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And although this sounds bizarre, we are less than 300 years from the present day, and collective memory is starting to come closer. Well, we can take that a stage further. That was an account of Europe invaded from, as it were, outside. There are many other ways you can look at it. You can look at synthesis between Islam and Christendom, not much of that, but it seems to be very fashionable these days to talk about it. You can look at all sorts of ways. You can also take a Russian perspective and look at the pressures on Russia. But the net effect is, I think it's fair to say, that in the 18th century, there was a change in, if you'd like to call it, direction. Yes, it is possible to point to Ottoman resilience. There's no doubt about it. But at the same time, the situation has changed. And it's interesting to note that Gibbon, when he looked at the question of whether the barbarians could succeed again, concluded two things. I mean, his headline story was no. He thought that the reign of Peter I, Peter the Great of Russia, Tsar from 1689 to 1725, and also the development of firearms and fortifications had changed the military situation. He also, as a lesser conclusion, said, and even if Europe collapses, civilization has been reborn on the other side of the Atlantic. But if we go back to his first interpretation, what he was essentially arguing is the geopolitics of Eurasia had changed, that the rise of Russian power, which we might start to think about from the late 15th century, Muscovy defeats Novgorod, 16th century, particularly with Ivan IV, Ivan the Terrible, significant gains in both the Baltic area, but even more the defeat of the Khanates, first of Kazan and then of Astrakhan, takes Russian power to secure all of the Volga Valley and opens the way, as it were, eastwards towards the Urals and Siberia. You could argue that that is beginning the Eastern question from another direction, that that gathers pace, albeit with considerable difficulty in the 17th century. The Russian establishment of their position in Ukraine, a contentious position from the late 1640s, being of particular note here, all of these being part of, from one dimension, depending upon your geographical ambit, an Eastern question, although one must be wary of overloading any particular phrase. But what one is getting then is a change. And this sense of change escalates with Peter the Great. By the time Peter the Great has died in 1725, not only has Russian power reached all the way to the Pacific, which it had done by the 1630s and with the Kotsks founded as a base in 1648, not only has it also led to movement towards the Caucasus, and indeed 1723, Peter the Great is annexing territory from Persia in Iran, but also Russia is a more potent power in what we would conventionally call Europe. Russian forces have defeated Charles XII of Sweden, Poltava in 1709. Russian forces under Peter get as far west as Denmark in 1716. So there is a sense of a different geopolitics. And that geopolitics, from the very perspective of Western Europe, triggers a new iteration of what one might call the Eastern question. You could argue that the Eastern question beforehand was the apocalyptic issue of whether the Turks would take over Europe as a whole, as depicted as one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse in Albrecht Dürer's engraving of that subject, as leading Protestant Brits in 1683 to pray for the defenders of Catholic Vienna. This sense of, you know, worlds in crisis, clash of civilization, whatever term you wish to use. By 1730, that seemed to be long way gone. And in fact, Henry Fielding, in his play Rape Upon Rape, or The Coffeehouse Politician, the title, the various titles, because there were two essential versions of the play, coming upon the idea that two London tradesmen, who are both a bit ridiculous, no, let's rephrase that, very ridiculous, are so absorbed in discussing in the coffee house the politics of the day that they neglect an attempt on the virtue of what the daughter of one of them. And the key thing that symbolizes the ridiculous nature of one of these coffeehouse politicians is that he thinks the Turks can conquer Britain. That seems so. By 1730, that appears completely redundant. Incidentally, 1730 was a year in which there was yet another violent rebellion in Constantinople with the Sultan murdered. But by that period, a new version of what you might call, from the Western European perspective, the Eastern question has started. And that new version is concern about Russian expansion. But whereas by the 1840s, the touchstone of that concern is going to be Afghanistan, in the 17 17- teens, the touchstone of that concern for Britain is Russia's determination to establish itself as a power on the Baltic. Now, it's worth bearing in mind that there are two principal powers in Western Europe that are concerned about this. I'm not denying that Spain and the Dutch are concerned, but the two principal powers that are concerned are Britain and France, and they each have a different narrative of the Eastern question. On the one hand is France. And France, it may be said, is one of the principal players at creating the sense of the Eastern question, although it tends to now be devoted to Britain. And the French notion goes roughly like this. France had created what was to be called the Barrière de l'Est, the Barrier of the East, which were states to the east of the Austrian Habsburgs, which were to be turned to for alliance in order to prevent the Habsburgs being too powerful. So Francis I in the 1530s had turned to Solomon the Magnificent against the Habsburgs, both Austria and Spain. And the three powers that the French looked to were the Swedish Empire, which they built up in the 1620s, 30s and 40s, Poland, and the Ottoman Empire. And the idea is that these would lean on the Habsburgs and therefore provide France with security. Now, the rise of Russian power, and indeed Austrian expansion in the Balkans, puts pressure on that. And from the perspective of French commentators, French politicians, there is a constant interest, accordingly, at trying to limit Eastern power. Now, this takes different forms. And, you know, in the time available, I can only say so much. And the key element is this. There is obviously variable consistency, because whereas prior to 1756, the French are the enemies of the Habsburgs most of the time, and therefore they lose nothing at building up their opponents to the east. So, for example, they're arming the Turks and providing military expertise and intercessionary diplomacy in the 1730s against Austria. That situation changes in 1756 because France becomes allied in the diplomatic revolution with the Austrians against Prussia. And even more so because swallowing very hard, Austria's ally is Russia, and there is a kind of entente with Russia as a result. France, Austria, and Russia all fight Prussia in the Seven Years' War. Well, yes and no, because at the same time, there is, and this lasts for the decades after the war, there is in French foreign policy what is known, I discuss it in my book on French foreign policy in the 18th century, what is known as the Secret du Roi. This is a parallel and separate foreign policy, the authority coming directly from the king, Louis XV, Louis XV, circumventing the foreign ministry, which knows nothing about it, in which French ambassadors, like the Duc de Broglie, receive separate instructions from Paris, contradicting their official instruction. And they're trying to build up this barrier against Russia. And after Louis XV dies, I think it's fair to say that elements of this remain the case. And in particular, Charles Comte de Vergennes, who'd been the French ambassador to Constantinople, the capital of the Turkish Empire, becomes eventually French foreign minister, a crucial role, incidentally, in the late 1770s, early 1780s. And Vergennes very much puts this as central to French foreign policy, total opposition to Russian expansion. And the particular area he's concerned about is Crimea. Catherine the Great, Catherine II, occupies and annexes Crimea in 1783. And to Vergennes, this is a real challenge. The development there of Russian naval power, and the Russians soon establish a naval base at Sevastopol, presents an immediate threat to Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, across the Black Sea. And there is need to prepare against it. Indeed, it is argued, there are two biographies of Vergennes, And they're both worth looking at. And it is argued that, and, you know, I can bear this out because, as I said, I've written a book on French foreign policy, and you can find this in French diplomatic correspondence of the Vergennes period, that the French really, in the case of the American War of Independence, want the British wrapped very hard over the knuckles, but Vergennes only wants a short war with Britain because he wants Britain then to join France, a French-led, as it were, European coalition, which is going to restrain, deter, and if necessary, drive Russia back. And that is the French policy agenda. And interestingly enough, it replicates the British-led diplomatic scheme, which the Stanhope-Sunderland ministry under George I had tried to create in 1719-21 to get Peter the Great out of his recent acquisitions of what we would call Latvia and Estonia. So this is not completely new. It represents an Eastern question, which is very much focused on what we would today see as the eastern borderlands of Europe, areas today that are politically questionable, precarious as a result of Russian pressure in them. Got to be careful about going to Salisbury, haven't I? Again, if I make remarks like that. And absolutely nothing to do with Afghanistan. Policymakers in the 1770s, early 1780s in London or Paris would have known nothing about Afghanistan. Okay. Now, this then leads to something that I think is really interesting, which is one of the rare occasions in which government loses control of the House of Commons in Britain, which is the Otchakov crisis in 1791. And I want to explain this because it actually strikes me as more relevant to modern foreign policy than when we tend to think. And if I can add a little historical note here, I think all historians should talk about themselves, not because they're important, I'm certainly not important, but because from the point of view of historiography, they're best placed to comment on themselves and their own work and to show how work fits in. Well, I did a book on British foreign policy in the age of revolution, 1783 to 93, which came out in 1994, had a chapter on the Otchakov crisis. And then I did a book on Parliament and foreign policy as a whole in the 18th century, and, you know, published by Cambridge University Press, a relatively, as was the other one, relatively major publisher. And I thought this might interest people at the time. The attempt by David Cameron as part of President Obama's led coalition to bomb and rocket Assad Syria by way of punishment for its human rights abuses was undercut by the British Parliament. And I tried to interest people at the time in maybe giving a paper or writing something for the newspapers. Nobody cared a damn. It was all in the past. Well, actually, there's some respects in which it's quite presentist. So let me just give you the background. We're looking here, the crisis occurs in 91. We're looking at the background. Britain, having been isolated in the continent after the War of American Independence, breaks free of that as a result of its successful role with Prussia in seeing down France in the Dutch crisis of 87. Britain and Prussia then sign an alliance in 88. And with France weak, the British and the Prussians become interested. The British, I think it's fair to say, drawn forward by a foreign policy elite, Francis Marquis of Carmarthen, then Duke of Leeds, the foreign secretary, Joseph Ewart, the ambassador in Berlin, who are anti-Russian and concerned about Russian expansionism. Russia and the Turks have gone to war in 1787. The Russians have done very well, making significant gains at the expense of the Turks. And essentially, the British and the Prussians produce what you might call a peace plan for Eastern Europe, based on the notion of the status quo ante bellum, going back to the situation before the war, territorially, or a process of territorial change which they are going to supervise in order to build up a strong Anglo-Prussian-led Barrière de l'Est, and in part because both Britain and Prussia are concerned about Russia. Not exactly coterminously, slightly different things. The Prussians see the Russians as having now a common boundary as a result of the first partition of Poland, as a very powerful military state, which, for example, had occupied Berlin briefly in 1760. So the Prussians are concerned in that respect. The British are concerned about Russia as a threat to what it sees as the balance of power, and in particular as a naval power. The Russian fleet had sailed into the Mediterranean via the Atlantic in 1769, and in 1770 had sunk the Turkish fleet, the Ottoman fleet off Kesme in the Aegean, and also the idea that the Ottoman Empire might succumb. And indeed, in a number of my works, I've drawn attention to British intelligence reports sent from agents in the Black Sea region, commenting on the precariousness of that region and its openness to Russian expansionism. So the Prussians press for a mobilization intent on, as it were, intimidating Catherine the Great to go back to a status quo ante bellum. She's not very keen, and the crunch point becomes the port of Ochakov and its surrounding area, which is quite extensive. But the port of Ochakov commands the mouth of two rivers, the Bug and the Dnieper. And this is a period when river links are important. This is to the west of Crimea. This is controlling the access to what we would call Western Ukraine. In late 1790, the British put an enormous effort into trying to create a diplomatic coalition aligned against Russia to definitely include Sweden, Denmark, Prussia, Britain, and Poland, as well as the Turks. And at the same time, the British government, although it doesn't want war, plans for war. In early 1791, the Russians, it's quite clear, are not going to back down. The British are buoyed by the fact that in 1790, they'd got the French and the Spaniards to back down with a naval mobilization in the Nootka Sound crisis over trade in the Pacific coastline of Canada, but more generally, the British threatened war over that. So the British launch a new naval mobilization, planning to dispatch a navy to the Black Sea, where incidentally they had no reliable maps, but also to concentrate on a large navy to be sent into the Baltic, where Russia is seen as particularly vulnerable. Its capital is at St. Petersburg. The plan is for the navy to enter the Gulf of Finland and, as it were, to dictate peace terms with the Russians. And I would argue that although there is this precursor between 1719 and 21, I would argue that it's really the Ochakov crisis of 1791 that begins the modern Eastern question. I've written about it at enormous length. I don't propose to repeat it, but essentially what happens is the government turns to Parliament to vote the necessary credits and to also, as it were, produce useful backing. Opposition mounts in Parliament, partly because Count Vorontsov, the experienced and skillful Russian ambassador, has been carefully cultivating the opposition as well as inserting material in the press. And let me tell you, people today think a lot of these things only happen today. Rubbish. This was as much part of the Ancien Regime in politics, anything more so. So Vorontsov is very closely linked to the opposition. The government knows that, but they're very closely linked to the opposition. The opposition, as it were, has some pretty good debates. There is a degree to which the government loses momentum. It maintains majorities, but its majorities are falling. And this causes a political crisis. The government changes direction. Pitt the Younger, the First Lord of the Treasury, decides this isn't going to work. The Marquess of Carmarthen, the Foreign Secretary, refuses to change policy. Carmarthen is forced to resign. a new foreign secretary, Pitt's chum, William Lord Grenville, is put in, and the government breaks with its policy, abandons its alliance with Prussia, and moves into diplomatic isolation. In other words, the political cost, and indeed, I think I would add fairly, the military uncertainty of the, as well as the diplomatic uncertainty, the alliance Britain had been assembling was a house of cards and Prussia was unreliable. All of those combined, and we can discuss which we think is more or less important, but what there is a dramatic change. So that is part of the background to the Eastern question, which is Britain looking for ways to restrain and lean on Russia as part of an attempt both specifically to affect the territorial control of individual areas, in this case, the northwest shore of the Black Sea, and more general area, in this case, the Black Sea as a whole, and then more generally, the balance of power is construed by Britain. And to argue that only one of those is significant, or that one is more significant than another, would, I think, be unhelpful. Now, we then move forward to the next dimension. And the next dimension of the Eastern question, which really comes in later in the 1790s, but again, very modern, is the route to India. And that dimension really comes in 1798. Now, again, there had been precursors, and again, people have written about them. A number of people, there was a British diplomat, consul in Egypt, Henry Baldwin, who talked about the significance of Egypt, en route to India. Again, I discussed this in my 1783 to 93 book. There were people who were looking at this issue already of overland routes to India. And I remember Suez was seen as a narrow isthmus. It was imagined that you could either drive a canal through the isthmus of Suez or from the Nile to the head of the Red Sea, or just transship there, however you did it. And then, as with the Romans and the Mamelukes and the Ottomans, all of whom had done this, send naval forces down the Red Sea. That was one obvious way of thinking about it. There was also the question of moving potentially along the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, because Iraq, Basra were part of the Ottoman Empire. So there's two routes that are very obvious there. So the route to the east, right. British position in India had been essentially commercial with very minor bases, in the 17th and for much of the 18th century. But from the 1740s in Southeast India and from the 50s, the late 50s in Bengal, the East India Company had become a significant territorial power and acquired resources as a result. They had become more significant than France. French forces had been defeated in India in the Seven Years' War, Battle of Bondiwash, capture of Pondicherry, the major French base. There had then been a rerun during the Franco-British stage of the War of American Independence, 1778 to 83, for those two powers. And linked to that, France and Britain had both been aligned with local powers. I mean, we call them local powers in term. I mean, India was a subcontinent. We're talking about powers that had armed forces greater than those of most European states. France's major ally in southern India was Mysore, which had been taken over by Islamic mercenary, Hyder Ali, becoming Sultan of Mysore, and then his son, Tipu Sultan, had succeeded. These were ambitious, successful, and expansionist rulers and good allies for France. And France and Mysore had cooperated in the early 1780s with, in fact, the French sending a force there. Now, we tend to only think about the French force that goes to America. A comparable French force going slightly later was sent to India. Harder route to go, but there were French bases en route, particularly Mauritius and Réunion, and French forces had arrived, and French admiral in the Indian waters, Suffren, had proved very effective in the early 1780s. So this was a significant idea. It was seen as a challenge to the British position. Subsequently, in the 1780s, British commentators, British ministers, frequently alluded to the danger that the French would challenge Britain anew in India. And indeed, one of the significant aspects of the Dutch crisis of 87 was the concern that the French would use the Dutch bases in Sri Lanka and India to that end. And the French also provided military assistance, particularly training, to a number of Indian rulers. So in the 1790s, Britain and France go to war in 1793, the French Revolutionary War, and the British become seriously anxious about the possibility of cooperation between their opponents in India and France. This is exploited from a different direction by an ambitious French general who doesn't want to demobilize his forces, which he has successfully led to victory over the Austrians in Italy in 1796-97. He wants, rather like Julius Caesar, after conquering Gaul, to find a new place to keep himself in the news, in power, in activity. And he alights on the idea of invading Egypt, which might seem a long way away. Actually, in Mediterranean perspective, and Napoleon was a Mediterranean, a Corsican by origin, much of his military career had been in Corsica or Toulon or Italy, Egypt doesn't seem that far away. So the French invade Egypt in 98. And a French army remains there till 1801, and Napoleon remains there till 1799. And for the British, this dramatizes a new sense of a threat, a new Eastern question. It's going to be all over again, like the loss of America. We're going to lose India. And this leads to a whole set of permutations. It leads to both the French and the British being interested in which side Persia is going to take in a struggle, which side the Afghans, who are pressing into northwest India at this point, are going to take. And it becomes even more difficult for the British, because the collapse of the Second Coalition against France in 1799 is followed by Tsar Paul I of Russia, Catherine the Great's son, talking about a new alignment with France and discussing the idea that France and Russia should jointly operate militarily against India, and in particular that the Russians will send an army there. So whereas at one stage we'd been talking about Otchakov on the northwest coast of the Black Sea, by 1800, beginning of 1801, we're talking about the potential of Russian forces coming into India. Now, one way of looking at this is just ridiculous fantasy. I mean, Talleyrand and others referred to Napoleon as thinking he's going to be a modern day Alexander the Great, who you recall had advanced across the Indus into India. And I think it's fair to say you can see an element of fantasy in Paul I, who can be presented as deranged. There is that way to look at it. But on the other hand, you can understand British concerns. They help to generate the first major British responses to the Eastern question in terms of actually lethality, as opposed to just military preparation. In 1801, British forces sent from both Britain via the Mediterranean and from India via the Red Sea invade Egypt. The key general being Abercrombie, defeat the French army there and force its surrender. And this is very much presented as the forward defence for India. At the same time, Paul I is murdered. Now, in large part, this is to do with Russian court politics, but I think it's fair to say it was also convenient for Britain, and there were Anglophile figures in the Russian court. If you like, what it and indeed it was part and parcel of the same thing. The British send their fleet to Copenhagen to ensure their entry into the Baltic. They take out much of the Danish fleet, and the subtext of that is to actually be able to lean on the Russians if there's trouble over Asia. So we have now a new scenario. The new scenario is that Egypt, the Ottoman Empire as a whole, is part of the forward defense of India. Again, you know, Afghanistan's starting to be mentioned, so that what happens is, as part of the forward defense of India, there's concern about the Afghans, because the Afghans had invaded India successfully from the 1750s onwards, for example, smashing the Maharathas in the Third Battle of Panipat in 1761. And there is British anxiety that the French will stir up the Durrani dynasty of Afghanistan into invading northern India, and thereby putting the British in grave difficulties. And as a result of that, the British are trying to persuade the Persians to lean on the Afghans. So in a way, you've already got, by the late 1790s, beginning of the 1800s, something that looks very much like what we would more classically see as the great game of the 19th century, and indeed elements up to the geopolitics of the present day. Now, after that sort of moment, that, as it were, epiphany of concern of 1798 to 1801, there remain periods of concern during the Napoleonic Wars. But it's fair to say Napoleon never again goes to the Middle or Near East. Napoleon's focus becomes much more clearly Central Europe, which he essentially conquers, between, in particular, in the War of the Third Coalition, and he then reiterates that in the War of the Fourth Coalition. The Fifth Coalition War, or the war, if you like, that begins with the invasion of Russia in 1812, there's no real detailed planning as to what this would have led to. There's no equivalent to the Hitlerian geopolitical speculation, mapping, ideas about what to do with the Soviet Union, not least because Napoleon envisaged that Alexander I would come to terms with him, and that his principal objective is to get Alexander to stop trading with the British, not to get Alexander to invade India. But nevertheless, even though there's less attention, I think it's fair to say that both the British and the French negotiate actively to secure the support, or their attempt to secure the support, of both the Turks and the Persians during the 1800s. There are diplomatic missions to Tehran, Isfahan, and Constantinople. There are differing and contrasting British and French views on the war between Turkey, the Ottomans, and the Russians from 1806 to 1812. The French wanting that war to continue by way of keeping the Russians busy, and the British wanting that war to end because they want Russia to be able to act against France. So these issues play a role. But at that stage, there is not yet a new iteration of the, if you like, deep Asian dimension of the great game. That is to come with what we're going to talk about next time, which is the new geopolitics that follows the Napoleonic Wars, and in particular, the extent to which Britain and France, once enemies, have an uneasy, but nevertheless, a real cooperation, allies in the Crimean War against Russia, but also, even more significantly, just simply not fighting each other. And in the absence of conflict between Britain and France, each of them is able to envisage different geopolitical concerns, and both of them become more concerned about Russia. And that will be our theme next time.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, for providing that geopolitical tour d'horizon of the balance of power in Europe, the Eastern question, and the roots of what we later come to call the Great Game. Thank you very much indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.